Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
A very good evening and welcome to A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn and my special guest this evening is well-known restaurateur, TV star and proprietor of one of Dublin's best-known Michelin star restaurants, the shining smile behind the star, Sally Ann Clark of L'Écrivain. You're very welcome to the programme.
Oh, thank you for that lovely introduction. Very nice, thank you.
You're very, very welcome. Sally Ann, going back to the beginnings of everything, right? Chicago to Dublin.
Oh my God, yeah. My parents emigrated when I was a baby and they came home when I was seven. And they did what everybody else did in the 60s. They went to make their fortune. They worked really, really hard. As my mum said, we didn't really live in Chicago. She said we resided there and we worked there. But I was in school there, so were my siblings. And they came home and the rest is, you know, we were put into school in Dublin. We were put back a year because you didn't have Irish in those days. And then when they discovered that you had done the curriculum that they'd already done, they offered to put me forward again. And my mum said, no, she's made her friends. And I still have those friends to this day.
In Chicago, one of the best cities in America. I was there a few times and absolutely loved it. By the age of 10, you were working behind the counter of your parents' clothes shop on the Crumlin Road.
I was seven. They bought
seven.
It. And yeah,
child labour.
My mum was saying the other day, she said, remember that box you had? In those days, they used to wrap bigger parcels as opposed to putting them in a bag. So there was a tin box that had a ball of twine in it with a hole that you pull the twine through the middle to wrap up the parcels. And that was the box I used to stand on because it was very sturdy. People used to think I was very tall at seven because I was standing up on this box. And I remember as I got older and older, there was one lady who used to come in, peer over the counter to see how tall I was getting and was I still standing on the box, you know? Yeah, I learned very quickly and you learn on your feet.
Was it difficult that moved the transition from the American lifestyle to the Crumlin Road?
Yeah, initially it was, especially for school because obviously I had a very broad Yankee accent and I made a friend in the first week in school, Charlotte, and she's still my best friend to today. So, and then I met other girls in school and we're all, there's eight of us. And we still meet up every 4 to 6 weeks. And some of us talk every other day. Some of us talk every week. So I made friends then. My mum was right. Because when they said, oh, well, she's done X, Y, and Z, we can actually move her forward a year. And my mum said, no, she's made her friends. Leave her where she is.
Very good.
Still 6 months younger than some and 6 months older than the others because I'm a September child, but that's the way it goes.
It was Loretto Convent in Crumlin Road.
Yeah. Fantastic. Brilliant. School, wonderful education. I was involved in the orchestra. I was involved in the choir. I was involved in the drama and I was involved in the debating team and you name it. I played hockey. And we just got in and did everything. I mean, my school day was obviously from 9 till 4 and we had an hour for lunch that I could walk home every day. But invariably I didn't get home till 6, 5, 6 in the evenings because between piano lessons, cello lessons, hockey, choir, drama, orchestra practice, we had our days filled and it was a wonderful, wonderful.
Where did your love of food come from? From an early age, I guess.
Well, my mom is a good cook. She said she's a plain cook, but she is a good cook. And my dad was a good cook. But my love of food was I ate what was put in front of me because that's what you did. But I didn't develop a love of food until a real love of food until I met Derry. There was lots of things that he would cook that I had never tasted before or I wouldn't eat. And he...
Were they like fancy things like what, lasagna or something?
No, it would be like foie gras or... I would eat crab and I would eat lobster and I would eat a certain amount of shellfish because my mum loves shellfish. She loves fish. She loves whatever. Obviously, I'd eat steak. But my, for want of a better word, my range of foods that I would eat exploded overnight because he had me tasting all sorts of things. And from the time I met Derry, all he ever wanted to do was open up his own restaurant. So I thought, that's fine. That's grand. We met. We got married 2 years later. And we had a look. We decided we'd get married, find ourselves a nice house, get ourselves sorted. And then we started looking for a restaurant. And I remember at the time we found the little place in Fitzwilliam. It was on the corner of Fitzwilliam Street and Bagot Street. And our address was actually Bagot Street. So we went to the bank manager and he told us we were absolutely nuts. He said, you've got a good job. He's got a good job. You've got money in the bank. Why would you open a restaurant? And you've got to remember, 1989 was still, there wasn't a big restaurant scene here. There wasn't a gastropub scene here. There wasn't a lot of fine dining either.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions you just touched on there. I mean, what was the restaurant scene like? I mean, when you met Derry, obviously that was after college, I guess, was it?
Yeah. I mean, I was 22. So, yeah. But my mom, I mean, we knew what we had every day when we'd come home from school, because whatever the roast was on Sunday, you had leftovers on Monday. And then Tuesday was usually pork chops. Wednesday, she'd do a stew. And Thursday, it could be corned beef and cabbage. Friday was always fish. Saturday was always a stew. And it was a big pot of stew because there could be 8 people behind the counter in the shop. So there was always people in and out, and we ate at different times. So that big pot of stew was on a low gas that people could come in and help themselves. And people knew if they came to our house, there was always a big pot of stew and there was plenty for everybody. And then it was back to whatever the Sunday roast was again if we didn't go out for Sunday lunch.
I remember as a young fella down in Cork, I think, I can't remember the first time, I think it was my confirmation maybe when I went to a hotel for something. You know, it was a different era, of course. But I mean, the restaurant scenes, it was a completely different playing pitch, wasn't
different.
It?
I mean, we opened up in July. We had 38 seats. And there was another table we could put in on a Saturday night if we needed to make a table of 4 into a table of 6. So we could have 40 people in. And we had great fun in that restaurant. The rules and regulations were not as stringent as they are now. It was a basement of a Georgian house that had been a hotel in previous times. You know what? We did our very best, but we did it our way. And the thing about it is, L'Écrivain, we needed a French name in order to be considered one of the fine dining restaurants at the time. And Derry was a classically French-trained chef. So we were L'Écrivain Restaurant Français. And as soon as we found our feet, we lost the Restaurant Français tag because he was adamant that he wanted to use Irish food from local Irish suppliers and to support all the artisan food people as well. And I mean, you had 30 years ago, you had a roll-on, roll-off service from France that brought your escargot, that brought your foie gras, that brought your cheeses, that brought everything in. Whereas now we have all these lovely Irish cheeses that are made all over the country. We have wonderful fish. We've wonderful meat. We've got great ducks that are Silver Hill up in Monaghan. I mean, we've got everything on our doorstep that people are actually rearing here now. We've got fantastic I say beef, we've got fantastic lamb. The pork here is among the best in the world. And he wanted to showcase that even then, 30 years ago, that we have all these things on our doorstep. Why buy them in from elsewhere?
Was it love at first sight then when you met Derry?
I suppose it was. I mean, he asked me to marry him about 2 weeks later. I told him to go home and sober
up. No messing.
Yeah, I said, go home and sober up. So, yeah, well, I was still only 22. I was still quite young. But, yeah, we got engaged a year later. And then I didn't want to get married until I was 25. So we got married a week or so after 2 weeks after my 25th birthday. And that was it. And I say I was 26 when we opened the restaurant.
Wow.
And we thought we could conquer the world, and we thought we were going to get in and we were going to, you know, do it our way. And we did. But at the time, everybody thought we were being very brave in one respect and very silly in another. Because we went to this talk before we opened the restaurant, and they said one of the things was never open in a basement. Never open where there's double yellow lines. And never have a name that people can't pronounce. And we were just about ready to open. We were in a basement.
You ticked all the boxes.
Yeah, we were in a basement. We decided on L'Écrivain, and there were double yellow lines everywhere. And we thought, okay, well, we're going to carry on. We've invested all this money to do this. And we moved from there 5 years later into what was the old Celtic Mews. And 5 years later, we got the premises next door and we leveled them completely. So we rebuilt the L'Écrivain that is there today, was rebuilt and reopened in 2000. And then in 2013, the place next door came up for sale, and it was 2015 15 before we got planning. So we have the live kitchen at L'Écrivain. So it's a kitchen that it's a fully, what would you say? It's a domestic kitchen, but it's there in the room with you. So the chefs are your entertainment. And the whole idea of it being a domestic kitchen is that anything they cook there, you should be able to cook at home. So it seats up to 24. And it just means that, well, we can't use it at the moment with the current COVID guidelines, but it was another great addition to what we were doing in L'Écrivain. It was something different.
I mean, it's a story really of pioneering and in a way sort of field of dreams, like daring yourself, believing, even though you were going against all the recommendations, it was like build it and they will come sort of thing, wasn't it?
Well, you know, if you're serving good food and you've got good service and you've got nice, comfortable surroundings and you're ticking all the boxes, people will come back because people will go for good food, but if they're not comfortable and they don't get the service they're looking for, they don't get the welcome. I mean, Ireland is known as the Ireland of the welcomes, and it may not always be Irish people in this day and age that are welcoming you, but that is our whole ethos, that the first thing we say to people when they come in the evening is, good evening, you're very welcome. And I think that is something that we Irish are actually very good at.
That brings us along very nicely, Sally, and to your first choice of music this evening. So why did you choose this piece of music and what significance does it have for you?
The first one I've chosen is Licky Lee, I Follow Rivers. And the reason is it was our son's favourite song. He used to play it over and over and over again. And it's one of those songs that when I hear it on the radio, I think he's around, he's close by, he's whatever. He died in New Year's Eve 2012. So unfortunately, we lost him to suicide. But we're not the only ones who've lost people to suicide, unfortunately, in this country. It seems to be,
of course,
it's horrible. We're very happy we had him for the 16 years we did. We have one of the eggs from the Jack and Jill Foundation that Derry decorated in. It looks like a helmet, and we have a picture of him with his car. He used to do rally driving, and we have a picture of him with his car underneath it, and that sits in the corner of the restaurant. So we'll obviously never get over what happened. We get around it, but we have him there. There's always a little piece of him, because himself and his sister, Sarah May, they've both been in the restaurant when they were, especially Sarah May, when she was tall enough to see over the counter, she was in, and she was very much a part of it. And during summers and weekends, especially if I didn't have a babysitter, I had him in doing washing the glasses and cleaning up in the background, and he loved to be in making cocktails and serving behind the bar.
Wonderful.
And it's not against the law to have your family to do that, by the way.
Wonderful.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine, 106.8. Sunshine, 106.8.
Welcome back to A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn, and my guest this evening is one of Ireland's best known restaurateurs, Sally Ann Clark. You were just saying to us there before the break about that very tough evening for you in Christmas 2012. Your whole world was turned upside down, and how, I guess, you never get over something like that, do you?
No, you never get over it. You get around it, and people say time heals things. Time doesn't heal anything, but time helps you get used to a new normal. And our whole world was turned upside down. I mean, there's his sister's world just turns upside down, and nothing will ever be the same again. And the only thing I can say to anybody who's gone through what we've gone through is your network of friends is very important. And that the fact that you're able to talk about the person that's gone, the fact that they know who he is and they know that you will bring him into conversations, and obviously with work, it's different, but the amount of people that have told us about their tragedies that we've known for 20 years or more that we didn't realize they'd lost a son or a daughter, we didn't realize they'd had tragedy in their own lives, they all of a sudden felt that they could open up and speak to us about it. Whereas having known them all those years, we never knew. We didn't know that they'd gone through the same thing. And again, they offered their support, which is, people are wonderful. Mm. And, it's amazing how warm and wonderful people can be, and not even by saying anything. Now, there's other people that avoid you like the plague. And
it's a real Irish thing, that, isn't it? A lot of people wouldn't know how to handle it, what to say to you. That's the difficult part, isn't
it? Well, for 6 months, we had everything cancelled in the restaurant. We had weddings, we had graduations, we had parties, we had birthdays, you name it. They all cancelled once that happened. And I know their reasoning was they felt that they couldn't celebrate while we were in the depths of grief. But, you know, turning it around, that's when we needed their support more than ever. And a friend of ours, Brian Kennedy, got a whole lot of people together and said, listen, we need you to get out there and tell them they're open for business. And he filled the place for us one night. And he got in a lot of people that would talk about it and tell them, listen, they need your support. They need you to come in, as opposed to, you know, and like, we had 40 people working for us. We went back to work a couple of weeks later. We were actually closed for the period during the funeral and everything else, as we close in January every year. But the fact of the matter remains that some people were very, very supportive and some people didn't know what to say. And to anybody out there, if you're in that situation, give them a hug. Put your hand on their shoulder. Obviously, you can't give them a hug at the moment with what's going on, but put your hand on their shoulder. Send them a text. Just tell them you're thinking of them. There is no words. There are no words that you could possibly say that would make anything better. They're going through an absolutely horrific time. But the fact that they know that you're there is what it's all about. But don't avoid them. Don't walk halfway around a room to go to a bathroom, you know, where you could have one right behind you just to avoid somebody. Don't not make eye contact. Don't cut contact with people like that, because you feel that, oh, they don't want to hear from me right now. You need people's support. You need, I mean, whether there's a death in the family, regardless of what the circumstances are, when somebody dies, your whole world is turned upside down. So you need your friends, you need your family. You need your family are going to be there for you anyway, but you need your friends and you need the wider community. And you just need to know that they're there. That if you do need anything, you can pick up the phone, and to know that they've texted you, they've phoned you, they've said, listen, I'm here if you need me. And I think that's something that we're getting better at doing, but it's because we're the best country in the world for funerals. We do them so, so well. But it's 6 weeks and 6 months and, you know, 18 months after that funeral is when you actually need people to pick up the phone to say, listen, I was thinking of you. Do you fancy a coffee? Do you fancy a pint? Do you fancy whatever? And I do think that that's something that we are getting better at, but we still have a little bit of a way to go.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful advice. Again, I suppose it would be unimaginable how you'd get out of bed every day and just keep going.
Well, we were lucky we had the restaurant, and we were very lucky that we had all these people who were depending on us. So we had to get in and we had to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves down. And as I say, you don't get over life-changing. It's life-changing. There's no way about it. A loss like that is unimaginable. But you do get around it, and you do have to, you do have to continue, you know, living. Unfortunately, I heard people say life is for the living, life is for whenever. And 7.5 years now since we lost Andrew. And there's not a day or a moment that goes by that we don't think about him, that we don't talk about him, especially among ourselves. But there are a lot of other people out there who've gone through exactly the same as we have. And again, all I say is, just remember them. Pick up the phone. Tell them you're there. You can't do anything to make it better, but you can be there to support them.
Yes, of course. It is difficult, isn't it? I mean, we've been through a lot. I mean, when you look at what we've been through, the last crisis we had in 2007-08, we had huge incidents, of course. But you're absolutely right. I think we are definitely, I mean, the priorities seem to have been in the last few years with even the government, Minister for Health, they seem to have definitely got the message, I think, Sally Ann, about mental health, you know.
I think it's so important, especially now. One of the supports we've done with our team is we've told them there's supports there in place if anybody feels that they need to speak about it. Obviously, if they don't want to speak with us, we have given them all the different email addresses and whatever if they need to speak to somebody, if they need to. Because this lockdown has been very, very difficult in so many. I mean, it's not just been financial. It's been mental. It's been physical. It's been it's knocked everybody for six.
The stereotypical chef shouting and roaring and throwing knives around the kitchen. I mean, there's always
that
been...
That doesn't happen. That's only you're watching too much television.
I mean, you know, that chefs, of course, have suffered a lot over the years. I mean, the stress levels are so high. I mean, what can be more stressful than plating up, trying to get everything together, you know, at the same time? I mean, you're experts at it. You've been doing it for 31 years. You're not just cooking food. You're running a business. You're making sure that your staff are motivated. I mean, there's so much involved. I mean, what is the secret to be able to do that for 31 years? I mean, you must have a magic formula, do you?
A really good team, and you need to be part of that team. And we've always felt that when we set up the restaurant all those years ago, obviously Derry had worked in other restaurants. I'd worked for other people. And we decided that we never wanted a situation where there was too many chiefs and not enough Indians. We wanted everybody to be an Indian and everybody to be part of the team. And Derry and I were part of the team as well, and we're still part of the team. So it's a case of, we wouldn't ask anybody to do something we don't do ourselves. We all take turns. We move people around. Derry moves them around the kitchen. So you could be doing starters today or this week, and you could be doing main courses next week, or you could be doing veg, or you could be doing something else. We move people around so everybody can do everybody else's job, which is part of their training. In the front of house, we have people that will be doing one section one week. They could be just doing service from the past on another week. They could, we move people around all the time. We take turns. Now, at this moment in time, we've somebody employed that all they're doing is the toilets, is the handrails, and all the constant touch surfaces. But normally we take turns, and somebody every service would be put on making sure the toilets are kept clean, making sure the common areas are in good order. And again, I take my turn like everybody else. And that's what it's all about. It's all about the team. And we have a wonderful team right now, but we've had wonderful teams all the way through, because Derry and I could never have opened up a restaurant on our own. We need people to work with us. And that's the whole, they don't work for us, they work with us. Wonderful. And I think that's very important. So there's no I in team.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Phrase.
There you go. Yeah.
Wonderful, Sally Ann. What was it like when you heard that you had got your Michelin star?
Oh gosh, it was, we couldn't believe it. It was actually Richard Corrigan who rang Derry, and he said, "You've got a Michelin star." And he said, "That's not funny." And then Richard rang back and he said, "I've just been speaking with Derry." He said, "He doesn't believe me." So he sent me a fax, as he did in those days, with our name on the list. And I said, "You're joking." And we got our star in 2002. So then, of course, they come in for lunch, and I recognized him straight away. And I said, "Hello, how are you?" And he had an older gentleman with him. And he said to me, "How do you feel about the star?" I said, "Well, we're delighted. We were busy. We were buzzy." So when he was on his way out, he handed me his card. He was actually the boss, Jeffrey Balmer at the time, of the Michelin establishment in the UK. And I just shook his hand. I said, "Thank you very much." And I said, we're absolutely delighted. But getting a Michelin star is one thing. Retaining it is something else. And I'm very happy to say we've kept it continuously for 18 years.
And it's a fabulous achievement that you've kept it. I mean, well done. And of course, anyone who's eaten there will know the reason why. What's also wonderful, you're part of the very prestigious Ireland's Blue Book, Sally Ann. And you have quite a little story to tell about that.
Well, we became members. We were invited to become members in 2004. Now, the Blue Book had been going since 1974, but they were predominantly for outside Dublin. And then they started inviting members from Dublin, because obviously their members were sending their customers to places like us. And they thought, well, whomever was at the helm at the time decided, well, we should have them as members. And then we were referring to members as opposed to just referring to restaurants. And they never had standalone restaurants in it before they took in ourselves, Gibbo's and Chapter One. It was always part of a hotel or part of an, I know, a recognized establishment. And it was great for us because they're a wonderful association. Their voucher sales are amazing. There's millions of Blue Book vouchers out there. So if you have one under the bed or you have one in a drawer somewhere, please come out and use it, because we could all do with the business right now. Then in 2014, I became their first restaurateur that they'd ever had as chairperson of the Blue Book. And I was delighted. I was delighted to be asked. And I really enjoyed it. And we've got a great team with Shelley and all the girls in the head office. But the thing about the Blue Book is they're mostly owner managed. or the managers have been there for quite some time, and everybody knows everybody, and we all touch base, especially during these trying times with COVID-19. We've all spoken with each other and said, well, we're doing this, and they said, well, we're doing that, and this, and where did you buy your screens? Where did you get your visors? Where did you get whatever? So we're all very much a membership and a group that we speak to each other regularly, and we're all there to help each other.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I was in Kilkenny recently, and I was lucky enough to stay in Mount Juliet, and I stayed in Butler's house. And,
beautiful properties.
Yeah, and I had dinner in Campania, Gareth Burns, lovely
that's
place
another,
down there.
But again, he's a standalone restaurant.
Yes,
and
that's
again,
right.
That those places are the little jewels in the crown of the Blue Book as well, because up until 2004, they didn't have any standalone restaurants. So it's more for people, if you've got a voucher and you don't want to necessarily go and stay the night somewhere, you can go and spend it in one of the lovely restaurants that's in the Blue Book. And you can still have a wonderful night, and you can still do, you know, so they're giving you so much choice. And as I say, it's a wonderful, I mean, the Blue Book itself is very nicely presented, but you've got properties all over Ireland. And you've got somewhere to go. You could, you know, you could make your itinerary that you want to go west and then go down south and come back to Dublin, or you want to go north and you want to go around. So we're an all-Ireland association. We're north and south. So we're treated as a 32-county association.
It's wonderful to hear that, because, and especially as you said now at the moment, that fabulous networking and support and giving people, you know, tipping, you know, just giving people little advice, and, you know, that's brilliant, isn't it? Because that's really what you need now, isn't it? I mean,
we all have the people that we've been using for years and say, well, we use Boland's and Gorey. We recommend that you talk to them before you speak to anybody else. Or it's all about sharing information.
For our listeners now, if you're thinking about Christmas presents now already,
oh,
right?
Blue Book vouchers.
Blue Book vouchers, yeah. Come on, and that would support Ireland and all the wonderful hospitality industry. So well, I think that's a great gift.
It is, but as I said, there's a whole lot of, there's millions of Blue Book vouchers out there that have not been redeemed. So if people want to come out, they're not actually spending money. They actually have this voucher, and they can come in and redeem it in a Blue Book property, and then we get paid, which is wonderful. So please come out and use your Blue Book voucher.
Beside the prize bonds.
Yes, absolutely.
Wonderful, Sally. And that brings us very nicely up to your second music choice for this evening. What have you chosen for your second piece of music?
ELO's Mr. Blue Skies. I am a huge ELO fan since I was about 12, and I actually got to see them the last two occasions they were in Dublin. Jeff Lynne plays the guitar, but he also played the cello. And I played the cello in the orchestra in school. And I used to torment my mum and dad that I wanted a white electric one like Jeff Lynne's. And it was no, and they won't let you play a white electric cello in the orchestra in school. So, I've been a lifelong fan. And as I said, when they come to Dublin again, please God they will, I will be as close to the front as possible and just singing away like everybody else. I absolutely love Jeff Lynne and their music.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com
on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Welcome back to A Taste of Ireland. I'm Ed Finn, and my guest this evening is one of Ireland's best known chefs and restaurateurs. And as I said earlier, the shining smile behind the star at La Criva. Sally Ann, welcome back.
Thank you. Well, just one thing, Ed. If I did the cooking, we wouldn't be open nearly over 31 years.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's a winning formula, you see.
The kitchen is his domain and the front of house is my domain. And as I say, never the twain shall meet. Because we've people saying, how could you work with somebody for all those years and not end up, you know, the fact that you're married. Like, we're 33 years married this year. We're 31 years, a little over 31 years in business. And I said, it's the formula that we discuss work in work and we never bring it home.
Fantastic.
And if we want to discuss something in between, we either stop on the way home or we'll, you know, stay in work to discuss it and go through it. But we do not bring it home, especially when the kids were younger. You could not bring work home. So work is work and home is home. And that's That's our formula.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing I do bring home on a regular basis is Derry's rashers and sausages and his pudding. Now, I used to be fond of one that came from Cork. I won't mention it, right? But I've been converted. And I had friends over recently, socially distanced, of course. But I cooked a breakfast and I must say, he does great sausages and the pudding is fab.
Divine,
whatever the little spices he has, the secret formula is brilliant. Just a few things I love to ask my guests, especially when you're such an expert in the whole food scene. What are your sort of pet hates when it comes to service, and what food don't you like?
Pet hates is when somebody tells you that they can't eat this, they can't eat that, and they can't eat the other, and then they'll turn around and they'll taste exactly what they've told you they can't eat from somebody else's plate. And you kind of look, and, you know, I remember there before Christmas, we had one lady in and she was allergic to lots of different things. And her husband sent us in the list beforehand. So we had a special menu for her. So when I went to take her husband's order, he ordered exactly the same. And I looked at him thinking, well, you have no allergies. And it was actually quite funny. He said, well, it's like this, darling. He said, it's our wedding anniversary. And he said, if I eat anything, he said, she's allergic to, he said, we won't be in the same bed together tonight. And I went, okay, too much information. I understand. And that's it. So people do sometimes share a little bit more than you.
I would not be good working in your business.
Well, you can imagine the look on my face when he ordered exactly the same as she did. Mm. And then he gave me the explanation. So I thought, okay, fine. One of the things at the moment is that we ask people to put their credit card details into a secure link to secure their booking. And we ask them to cancel 48 hours before they come in, or we will charge them. And I mean, I don't charge if I can resell the table, but there's one on TripAdvisor at the moment, a lady who said that we were a disgrace asking for a credit card details, and the fact that she couldn't possibly give 48 hours notice if she was going to cancel. And I think that's grossly unfair for any restaurant in this day and age. We found that if you ask people for their credit cards, 99% of them will actually cancel within the 48 hours and release the table for somebody else. We should really be treated more like a cinema or an airline or a theatre, that, you know, you should expect to pay if you're not turning up.
Oh, no,
if you reserved a seat.
Yeah, I think you're separating the wheat from the chaff there. I mean, in fairness, you're calling it out, because I totally agree with you. I mean, I mean, did you see that recently there? One of those chefs in the UK, there was 16 no shows.
The thing about it is, if you cancel, you're giving the chance for somebody else to use that table.
Absolutely.
It's still the culture here of no shows, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's
and
terrible.
During the boom times, people would book 5 restaurants and they would meet for a drink beforehand and decide which lucky restaurant was going to get their business, which is shocking, because the other 4 were left with empty seats on a Friday night or a Saturday night. Our daughter's working for brand events in the UK. She's working with Tom Kerridge. And I said it to her and she said, yeah. She said, it's the very same thing there that it is here. If you can't make a reservation for whatever reason, pick up the phone. Even if it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, we still have a chance to sell the table. But if you can't make it, please tell them.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, it's just a common decency and a bit of respect, really,
it's
isn't
manners.
It?
It's actually
it
manners.
Is. Absolutely. And I agree with you about I think treating it like if you book a flight somewhere, you know, and you pay your money, and if you don't turn up, well, that's your problem.
You don't get the money back. But this was a huge problem before the lockdown. We were getting up to 20 covers a week, no show. There could be 2 some nights, there could be 4 others. And then if you called people, you have their phone number, you have their details, they wouldn't answer their phone. And you think, well, if you're not going to make it, please let us know. We won't wait for you. We won't hold the table. We'll put somebody else on it. So what we've decided now since the whole COVID is that every table you need to put your credit card into the secure link. And as I say, that just means that if you don't want to put your credit card in, that's fine. But you're releasing the table for somebody that does, and somebody that actually wants to turn up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I do think that that's the way things are going to go.
Yeah.
Restaurants in the UK are actually taking deposits, and they're non-refundable if you don't cancel within a week of your booking. So we haven't
done
that
yet. Well, I
think
that puts manners on people, you know, and I think that's absolutely the way to go.
Yeah.
I remember being in Switzerland a few years ago in a fabulous, I think it was also Michelin star restaurant, and I was with a few journalists, and we were ordering venison or something fabulous, and one of the guys, I won't mention, turned around and said to the chef that he decided he'd prefer to have a fondue. Now, you can imagine that the chef, there was a few words and there was no fondue anyway. Right. What is your guilty pleasure? I mean, what do you always have in the fridge? What do you love to sit when you're watching Netflix? What do you love to sit down with?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. Well, there's usually bread and butter, and there's usually cheese and some smoked hams. And there could be some prosciutto ham. I have a very sweet tooth, so my guilty pleasure would be some sort of cake. Some sort of chocolate cake, preferably. You know, double chocolate one?
I do.
So that would be my really, really guilty pleasure. But when we come home at nighttime from work, the first thing you do is have a cup of tea. And then you could have something sweet like that, because again, we try not to eat too late at night. We usually have a staff lunch in the 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we try and make that our main meal. But we all sit down together, the kitchen and the restaurant, and we all chat over our food and about service that's going to happen that night. And then we do our briefing. And again, it's all about the team. But the guilty pleasure, a glass of rosé, really, I suppose, would be the one thing I'd always have.
A glass of rosé and the chocolate cake.
And the chocolate cake, or just chocolate.
Wonderful.
Plain, either Cadbury's or Galaxy chocolate, absolutely. And a glass of rosé, that would be. And it doesn't matter whether the rosé is sparkling or whether it's just rosé. That would be my real guilty pleasure.
Wonderful. Just finally, I mean, as a restaurateur yourself, this is a hard one, I suppose. What restaurant do you love to go to?
Well, Sunday is our only day off as such. And one of the places we love to go to is the China Sichuan up in Sandyford. I just find, because they do everything there, I love Chinese food, but I like the fact that you can get lobster there, or you can get duck, or you can get whatever. So, and it's only 15 minutes drive away from us, so we can get a cab there and a cab back. There's lots of lovely, lovely restaurants that I would love to mention, but, and we do try and go, we have a little house in Wexford. So we love Marfield House. We love the duck. We go down to the Tower of E if we want something a little more casual. And there's lots of other little places in Goree that we would go to. But as far as a Sunday lunch at home, Derry would cook. Very seldom do I cook, but I'll go out and I'll do the shopping, but he'll do the rest. I'll set up and I'll clean up. But yeah, the China Sichuan would be one. And there's another place down the road from us that only opened there recently, Pulafuka House. And again, they do a lovely Sunday roast. So it depends on where we are, who's with us, and how far we have to drive.
Finally, Sally, and before we finish up, can you tell us about your last piece of music that you've chosen this evening, and just why you chose this?
I love Adele. I think her music's amazing. But I think Skyfall, for me at the moment, it's one of the songs I would love to have played at my funeral. And I don't want to sound too morbid, but I also feel that coming to the end of L'Écrivain and coming to the end of whatever, I mean, that whole thing is, this is the end. Hold your breath, count to 10. And I think that's very apt for us at the moment, with the closing of L'Écrivain being imminent. And it's going to be closing of, as you say, one chapter and the opening of another. And I just think this song just says it all.
Wonderful. Sally Ann Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is the end. Hold your breath and count to 10. Feel the earth move and then hear my heart burst again.